Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. I'm delighted today to bring you a new colleague, Eva Papp. Eva has written a book that I want to share with everyone called Chasing the Wild Authentic, a field guide to the practices, boundaries, and North Star of living your truth. It's an intriguing title, and I want to go right into what's at the heart of the book. But first, let me tell you a little bit about Eva. Eva is a licensed psychotherapist and worked for 25 years in private practice. These days, she's applying her model to a variety of clients and groups to really bring out this powerful work to the world. She has pursued research, both clinical and field, to discover what traditional cultures and practices might offer in response to our collective quest for well-being. And there was a really intriguing piece on her jacket that I want to talk about because it says, drawing from 25 years as a psychotherapist and her field research that stretched from the open steppes of Siberia to the dense jungle of the Peruvian Amazon. What a fabulous background, and what an unusual piece of field research to be bringing into this guide that's designed really for all of us who want to improve the quality of our lives. So, Eva, thank you so much for gifting me a copy of the book because yes. I loved reading it and also being here today.
Thank you, Sally. Thank you for having me.
You are so welcome. Tell me, how did this journey begin? Because you have a psychotherapeutic background, you have a degree from Antioch, and you were successful in what you were doing, but you made the decision to take your ideas and bring them into a book. How did that happen?
Well, it really was a many-stage process. After maybe 20 years of clinical work, I started feeling somewhat restless, would be a good word. At some point, I began to realize that something more was coming and something more was going to be required. And it wasn't enough just to be doing my therapeutic practice. So I started paying attention. And about a number of years ago, I decided to close my practice to sort of fully avail myself of what this new direction was, even though at the time I still didn't know what it was. But I was getting a sense that it had to do with rekindling my ayahuasca work. And I had, in the certain periods of time during my clinical practice, I did some research with colleagues here in Seattle on ayahuasca, which is a South American spiritual tea. And it's also a psychoactive agent. And traditional cultures use it to connect to higher realms of knowledge and really meet the divine. And colleagues and I had been looking at using ayahuasca in the treatment of anxiety, depression. Also, it had been researched and used for drug and alcohol addictions. And we were applying for NIH grants at the time to do this research full on. But they weren't really approving psychoactive research agents at that time. Things have changed now. Of course, psilocybin, psychoactive agents using for PTSD. I mean, there's a lot of work that's going on now, ketamine, that wasn't possible back then. Anyway, we did not get the grants. And I stepped away because I became a parent also at that time, stepped away to just focus on my practice and, you know, raising our child. My colleagues continued the work. Anyway, so I... when I started getting itchy, I had the sense that it was going back and rekindling some of my work around ayahuasca. And I and subsequently went to Peru, and I connected with a healer there, and she and I agreed to collaborate. Although it was not clear how we were going to collaborate, she being in Peru, me being here, and of course, her not speaking, not even Spanish, right? She was from the Shipibo tribe, so she spoke Shipibo, and of course I had to have translators while I was there. Anyway, long story short, our agreement to work together provided sort of what I think of as an opening of a portal that allowed me to sit down and write the material of the book. The book is a series of psychologically grounded skills and tools and strategies that anyone can use to move from a place of not really feeling in alignment with who they are into moving into alignment with who they are and continuing to do so to experience more happiness and joy and abundance and ease and purpose and meaning and impact in life, right? So, and you know, my work in that research team really was because I had done previous research in Siberia when I was in graduate school. So there's
what was your research there in Siberia?
Well, when I was studying psychology, you know, the psychology most of us study is very rooted in a sort of European Western mindset. And I was like, no, these are not the only ways we can think about mental health and mental well-being. There are other cultures who have something to say about these questions. So I was very keen to go way outside of a Western construction of well-being and really look at what indigenous cultures had to say about the matter.
Right.
And, you know, shamanism starts in Siberia, and I was very curious about what the shamans would have to say and if they had anything to say of relevance to, at the time, 20th century psychotherapy. So I put together a couple of, self-study programs because I was at Antioch. I could do that. One was, you know, what does shamanism have anything to contribute? And also, how do we look at psychology in context and begin to pull apart what is really cultural conditioning and what is really essential to human functioning and well-being?
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
So those are the two directions I went to study.
Mm-hmm. Right. I love that. And it seems so timely because I think a lot of us are bumping up to against the limits of a sort of constructed Anglo-capitalist model of all sorts of things that impact us in ways that we don't even know.
Exactly.
And so for you to challenge the boundaries and actually take on deep study of Siberian model and then the ayahuasca and the indigenous wisdom from South America and all, it's amazing. When you wrote the book, though, you didn't share those stories of being in Siberia and, you know, attending ayahuasca ceremonies or going to Peru. I'm sure that was a decision you made. Can you tell me why?
Yeah, that's such a great question. Well, I think the beauty of psychology and psychotherapeutic work, which I deeply believe in, really rests on the fact that is open. It's open. And you come without, well, you're supposed to come without, you know, an agenda for your clients.
Right.
And that is the way I practice. I've worked with people from all different religious traditions, political ideologies, because it really is supposed to be this agnostic practice where you welcome all and you work with all, right? So I didn't want to, but every therapist brings their background to the situation.
Yeah.
So I, in writing a book, I wanted to write a book that was accessible to all. And I didn't want to set up obstacles at the beginning. Now, if you read the introduction, I do talk, this book is written from this perspective.
Right.
Right. So I laid my cards on the table, but in keeping it really psychologically grounded, for me, meaning accessible and in a way, and I wrote it in a way to make it as absolutely accessible to all people, right? I didn't want to throw up obstacles by saying, this is a, you know, this and that.
It's so interesting. And I really respect that decision, because these days so many people are, because especially with the reentry of psychedelics and psychedelically assisted therapy, how you call that. Now those stories are coming out a lot. Mm-hmm. So for you, they were informing your work, but you weren't sort of seizing the glamour of those journeys. And then also putting a separation from people who would still be a little freaked out by shamanism, by psychedelic assisted journeys and things like that.
Well, you know, the book is not about me, right?
Yeah.
It's not a glory walk. It really is about what I've learned that I feel like could be helpful to others.
Yeah.
So I want to have the people I'm serving be the focus.
I get that. That's clear in your book. However, as an interviewer, I'm curious, how do you think the book is different because of your ayahuasca journeys? Did they inform you? Did they you said that they created a portal. What can you give me a sense of what that portal was and how your work might have been different had you not traveled through that portal?
Well, okay, so I want to ground what I'm going to say. Every creative, as you must know yourself, has an inner voice, a muse, a knowing, a directive. Go left, go right, push harder here on this piece of clay, step back. You have the inner guidance. So when I say a portal, I'm really talking about that my intuition became strengthened by what I would call the ayahuasca teachers, that I was accessing information that I might not otherwise have access to. How did that play out in the book? Well, I felt the writing of the book was itself a journey for me. Mm-hmm. For instance, I went in with this desire to share the fundamental skills that I believe everybody needs to function well and to be happy, and certainly in complex times, which we find ourselves in. And that's what I set out to write the book about, to convey these, you know, basic psychological skills. And if you go through the book, you realize, oh, I've heard some of this before. There's nothing like magical here. Although I do add some innovative ways of doing things in the book. But what happened is I began to see a thread from the beginning to the end. So, you know, one thing that psychology doesn't do, it doesn't tell you, well, where are we taking you? We are taking you back to a place of hopefully functionality. They don't then say, okay, and then your functionality should be pointed towards this end, or you should be doing this, or you should be doing it. We don't do that in psychology. It's like, let's just get you better, and then you move on from there, which is great. But people are hungry for knowing, like, what's the purpose? What's the point of me, right? So these are some of the things that I could be given information about, because the book is from A to Z. It's like we start with, well, how do we know ourselves? Because it's a journey of authenticity. How do we know ourselves? How do we express ourselves once we know who we are? How do we then protect ourselves in a world that may not really be interested or be hostile toward who we are? And then how do we live the highest version of who we are, right? So there is this trajectory, and there is clear direction. And I believe that was given to me. It's something that I may not have been able to put the pieces. I mean, it's the way the book is stacked to bring us to a conclusion, I think is profound. And I say that because I share the authorship in a way. So
that's so interesting. I appreciate that you're saying that, because one, the book is super well organized. It's well presented. It does stack. You make it clear. And at the same time, I'm fascinated that there was a kind of guidance that was opening this up. And you were doing the hard work, but that guidance, I think, is really also important to us. And I went through something similar because, you know, my book is called Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I struggled a bit with how do I describe the muse in a way that doesn't alienate? It was same deal.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a spiritual force, a subtle force, whatever. But once I start using those words, people are going to go, oh, that's good for you, but that's not me. And so to be able to both own my own experience with it, but also to say, but for you, it may be the inner voice. You may call it your gut. You may call it your intuition. You will have your own vocabulary for it. And so if you want to hear my experience, great. I'll share about that. But I don't want it to distance you mm-hmm. from the listening mm-hmm. that's so key to the adventure. So,
Well, you know, at core, I believe we each have a touch of the divine within us. And hewing and discovering and being able to apprehend what that is will take each of us to alignment with our truth. And I believe it's an ultimate truth that we all share. So this book is the pathway, or strikes a pathway to knowing how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And regardless of where you are, it's expansive because it's not a one and done, right? It's a journey. How do I get closer to who I am? How do I become more authentic in time? How do I begin to understand my experiences, read my actions and the results of my actions so that I can turn what I learn into going further on this path of authenticity? That's what this book is about.
And I love how you say that. It's not one and done, because I think maybe in the Western model, and you tell me what you think here, we do have some of that heroic journey model. I love the heroic journey, but it has that sense of you put things in place and you conquer whatever, and then you get to the top of the mountain, and then ta-da, you know, you've done the journey. Whereas you're saying, here are tools that you may keep coming back to for all of your life. You will, like a spiral, you will keep using them again and again, not like there's a finish line.
Absolutely. In fact, I talk about the book as a spiraling journey.
Right.
The material is presented in a sort of spiraling process. You learn something new. We revisit what we know. We integrate that new. We move forward into new. We go back. It's constantly spiraling in on itself because there's a ton of information in that book.
There is a lot.
Yes.
There is a lot.
And in order to integrate it, you have to go back and revisit and then work from what you know to move forward. So that's
right.
Spiraling is part of the path of this book, and it goes forever. But the idea is that you go draw ever closer to who you are with the capacity that comes from acting in alignment with yourself, which I believe are the fruits of a good life.
Yeah. I was interested because, and I also appreciate how you said, you know, some of this is not new. It's out there. You know, if you read Martha Beck or others who are talking about finding your North Star and going there, you know, there'll be similarities and all. I was curious about pillar number three, which is boundaries,
mm-hmm.
because I don't hear as much about boundaries. I hear more about, you know, you do the work to find out who you are and you connect with your North Star and figure out where you're going and then overcome some obstacles. But boundaries was another element. Did you feel like it was adding something to the story that you had heard out there? Or what did that particular element represent for you?
What do you mean the story I heard out there?
Well, one of the questions that I ask in reading your book, I'm going to just back up a second and say, so what is she contributing that would be different than the journeys of self-exploration that I've heard about. So I was listening for that as I was reading about it. And then when we came into the third pillar where you were talking about boundaries, I thought, I don't think that this is as covered in some of the other self-help or books I've read. There's something that is essential here, but I haven't heard it as much. And I wondered if that was your impression as well.
It's interesting. When I was writing the book, I was very cautious not to read anything. I only after
yeah,
it was done did I do any research, because then, you know, you have to do comparative research and all the rest of it. I did not do anything. I didn't read anything. I knew people out there writing
mm-hmm.
because I just wanted to stay purely focused on this internal journey that I was in and what I needed to write about. And boundaries are an extraordinarily essential aspect of authenticity. In fact, the fundamental boundary between who you are and who you are not, which I cover in the book, defines your authenticity, differentiates you from anybody else. And then getting clear about the nuances of who you are and who you are not brings us ever closer to who we are as individuals. But boundaries are not really well understood, right? Or if they are understood superficially, to be able to carry them out, how to do that, and the obstacles that arise when you try to do that are not well covered, right? Mm-hmm. So I introduce, you know, and this is in the third section, the third zone of authenticity, which is about protecting who you are. I introduce the definitive no, how to say no, mean no, and deliver on your no without like hemming and hawing, whatever. That's incredibly important. I call it the first boundary maneuver. Then there's the boundary maneuver of yes. People don't think about yes as a boundary. It absolutely is. Well, what does that mean? And how does that make a contribution to protecting who we are while we advance who we are, right? And then there's the flexible a boundary maneuver, which is saying yes and no at the same time. Whoa, what about that? Well, that opens up incredible options for how you move forward, right? Because the world is complex. There's not one way to do things. And the more nimble you are in understanding where your no is and therefore where your yes could be, it opens up all these possibilities for forward motion, right? And then the last, which is not well covered almost anywhere, is internal boundaries. And this is actually the thing that gets people hung up. Even people who are relatively good at boundaries really struggle with internal boundaries. And I do a lot of...
Can you say what an internal boundary is?
Yeah. So this is an easy example. An external boundary is, you know, someone's making a lot of noise, I close the door. Well, you know, I've just put an external boundary, the closed door. And what we do with external boundaries, if we try to keep out what would harm us and bring in what, you know, benefits us. We, in that example, we're closing out the noise, we're bringing in the peace, right? Because we needed it. That's a boundary. It's external because we do it out in the outside world. That same reflex happens internally as well, where we act to keep out what would harm us and bring in what's good. So for a quick example, you know, teenager makes a snide remark at you, you know, and they know how to be cutting at that age, right? Go right for your... So if you have a good internal boundary, you might just ignore it and move on and be completely unperturbed, right? Or you might say something, oh, you know, that's not really a kind way. Can you address me differently? And then move on. But you don't get flipped out, right? Because you have an internal boundary. Mm-hmm. So you know how to ignore what doesn't.
Interesting. Yeah.
And, but there is way more to it than that. And my chapter 10, which is the chapter I struggled with tremendously in writing, is all about internal boundaries and introduces concepts that really are, I don't believe, out there in the world yet. So I wanted to make a contribution, which I do in several areas to the field of psychology, talking about things in new ways that haven't been looked at before.
Yeah.
And chapter 10 is one of those, the internal boundary section.
And that stood out to me as, you know, thinking, yeah, we all need this, because there is this also place, you know, like I use the Joseph Campbell climbing the mountain, mm-hmm. heroic journey. There's also the sort of more of a new age, you know, you become enlightened and then you realize that all is one. Yeah, which is great. That is a kind of perspective. But meanwhile, down here on the planet, those of us who are meditating and want to expand our consciousness are having to deal with life every day.
Thank you.
And that is the part of the journey that also needs guidance, because, hello, I can believe that we're all connected and all is one, but how the H do I deal with current reality?
Thank you. And that is why I wrote this book. And that is why it's so relevant for these times.
Yeah, I think so too. I think so too. And as you were speaking, I was thinking, oh my gosh, Eva, this is, and just to listeners, we're talking with Eva Papp, the author of Chasing the Wild Authentic, a book that is so intriguing and so relevant for our times, because that internal boundary setting is something I think we're all grappling with. It's like, how do I not let the bad guys get to me? You know, however you want to say it. Mm-hmm. You know, how can I be an agent in the world, an agent for change, deciding what I can do and what I don't do? that's a big enough question. But then that question of how do I sleep at night? How do I reinforce a boundary that says, yeah, I don't even know what it says. It's so difficult right now. Mm-hmm. You want to speak to that?
Well, just one thing that you said, I do want to speak to. It's about differentiating. Once you have, and that's why the internal boundary comes at the end of chapter 7, 8, 9, where we talk about external boundaries,
right.
You know, the no, the flexible no, the yes, right? Because you have to differentiate, because there are opportunities to exercise internal boundaries. But if you're in a situation of external situations that's not safe or otherwise, you do need to exercise an external boundary. And external boundaries are for external experiences. And a lot of what's going on today is actually creating real harm.
Yes.
And requires a real world response.
And safety and external boundaries.
Thank you. And so internal boundaries is internal work, where the things that someone's trying to get your go, it's the, you know, sort of the backhanded compliment or the incessant, what's that word I'm looking for? What is it when somebody is gaslighting? Thank you.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Right.
The incessant gaslighting that's going on right now. These things just, they don't harm you. They're like the emperor with no clothes, which we're quite familiar with. It's just a lot of drama.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where you exert your external boundaries. I give an example of the book. You know, you're driving at the speed limit. It's a really nice day. And you notice somebody in the rear view mirror of your car, you know, suggesting you go faster and waving their arms at you and flailing and all the rest of it. Well, if you don't have an internal boundary, you might have a big reaction to that. Either you might want to slow down, or you want to speed up, or you might want to get mad yourself. Or with a good internal boundary, just continue on your way and let them have their experience.
Yes.
But you don't take it on. That is where an internal boundary really shines.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing to do. They're not going to harm. They're just the drama. It's you hold out negative energy and how to do that. And that is chapter 10.
I have a challenge for you.
Sure.
You know, if you're, because although this book is just out and it's great and we should read it as, but I know it's the accumulation of your thinking over a period of years. And you were probably in the home stretch when the worst of the worst started happening politically. But one of the questions that I and my friends grapple with is this place of how to be aware of what's going on without succumbing to despair or hopelessness, because that's the kind of internal boundary management that I'm trying to do, to be able to say, no, I don't want to be in my cocoon and not aware, because I want to be able to support my community and help where I can. But when I'm in a conversation and all I hear is negativity, and all I hear is, you know, no hope, we're not going to be able to stop them, and here's how they're how people are being hurt right and left, I can feel my spirit starting to shrink. And then I'm saying my creative capacity is not being helped by this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm going, you know, I need to stay alive and vibrant and caring about the world. This is not helping. So it's both an external, remove me from that conversation, but also there's a legacy that carries on inside of me, because I do have those thoughts inside of me. It would be really great if you wrote about internal boundary management in a time of despair.
Well, you know, chapter 10, internal boundaries, is a great start.
Yeah.
But what I would say to you is, what is it that you need to create your emotional balance? And if you're feeling like that, then there's a call, there's something to do. And the model that's in the book, I call active authenticity, because authenticity is not meant to be just worn. It's meant to be acted upon, because it's through action that we discover more and more of who we are and begin to experience the fruits of acting with authenticity. So yes, take action. If action right now makes you feel better, like I'm out protesting, I'm out calling my senators because I need that.
That
makes me feel in balance, empowered. I surround myself with news that supports my soul, where I see the positive things that other people are doing, right? And I limit right now how much, I mean, I read headlines for five, you know, papers maybe twice a day, very fast. So I'm up on it, but I'm not taking in the energy, and I only expose myself. I'm on Substack a lot so that I can take in the positive energy of people who are doing things and have a vision of what's coming next. And I think the biggest thing is to do your work in the world, because I do believe that it is through each of us really following what is authentic to who we are, our joy, our power, our passion. And if enough of us do it, it comes together. We are going to discover a very authentic, powerful path forward, but it's going to come from people doing their work. So what is it that you need to protect yourself externally and internally, right? So that you can do that life-giving work at this time.
Those are great questions. There are super great questions. And for me, it's calling, you know, it's doing the obvious actions, but it's also taking time in the art studio.
There you go.
You know, and managing the both and. And also for me, you know, I've been thinking about this recently, that we often talk about life as a solo performance when really it's an ensemble. And each of us doing our authentic part, playing the role that we're meant to play, creates the ensemble. And I have to say, you know, will I solve this problem alone? No. Am I capable of solving it? No. Do I trust that as a ensemble of authentic agents, we'll find our way through? Yes, I do. So that's where I, I'm learning. I'm learning on this journey and all. Thank you for sharing so directly from the book. I want to make I also wanted to know, because I'm so interested in people's creative journeys, what it was like to become an author and publisher, because that's a whole journey in and of itself. It's one thing to discover who you what you want to say, but then carrying it through into a published work is a feat unto itself.
Absolutely.
How did that journey change you?
Well, let me start with how I got to the journey, because I was not planning on writing a book.
Really?
I developed a curriculum of this model, and I was teaching it online. And I did a one-day workshop here on Vashon, and one of my students said to me, Eva, you really need to put this in a book so that people could get the basics. So they come to the workshop, they can really get to the next level. And I said, you know what? I think you're right. And that started a three-year journey of me writing this book. So it came from someone else, the idea that this should be in a book, but I'm really glad because now I can pivot off the book. And so, you know, I can say, well, you know, that's in chapter two. Why didn't you go read that? And then let's have a higher conversation, because this material can really fly. And that's why I'm enjoying doing workshops, because, you know, we start with certain premises, we work them out, and then people bring extraordinary things, and it just goes. So that was the impetus for starting the book, and it was an excruciating journey. And I wanted to say this about your prior thing. You know, we set out with an intention, but on a real journey, you don't know where you're going. And I think that that is a hallmark of a real journey, that you step out in absolute trust, because you don't know. Because if you know already the end point, it's not really an extraordinary journey, because the end is set. To really get to the next level, you got to go not knowing. And that's where we all are right now. We're applying our gifts to the world, having good boundaries, and we don't know where it's going to end up. So I think maybe the seeds of something extraordinary could be germinating here. So that's that political thing I wanted to add at the end there.
Brilliant ad. Thank you for that.
Yeah. But for the book, I didn't know, but I trusted I was being guided. So I just kept writing. And there were extraordinarily difficult moments. I thought I was going to lose my mind because I didn't know the answer. I'd come to a place in the book, I'm like, I don't know how to untie this knot. And I would just be open and really prayerful and listen. And days later, I would see something. But the awful thing is, if you see something in chapter 9, then you have to go back and rework the whole thing. So that's what's hard about creating a book that's structured like that.
Right.
So it was immensely difficult, but then it finished, and then I was on the publishing piece of it. So,
did you ever nurture the dream of being traditionally published, or did you know you were going to take your own book out into the world?
Well, a couple of things on that. there are a lot of things that you give up when you go towards traditional publishing, like the design of my cover, which I love, and it's an expression of my life's work, and all the images on there. You know, there's an image of Vashon. There are images of Siberia, where I did my original research in the Sayan Mountains, and of course we named our son Sayan. So every time I see, and there's even a ridge called the Great Sayan that I made sure was on the cover. The book is an homage to my life in a way, and every time I look at it, I just feel joy. Right, I couldn't have done that if it was traditionally published. They would have slapped some cover on it and like, there you go, there's your book. So I wanted this to be the richest experience of love and generosity and giving to people that I could muster. And so having that level of control of it was really important. The second thing is to go through the process of finding a traditional publisher can take a really long time. And I felt an urgency about getting this book out. And the third thing is they typically, if you have a huge social media following, they'll give you a contract, no problem, because they know they can sell a book. They don't really care about, at some level, of course they do, but on some level, they really just want an audience. And being a psychotherapist for all my career, it's very private. It's confidential. You don't go out sharing. So I had no real social media following. So I knew, even though, and I got, so I said, what I'm going to do, I'm going to send it out to like 15 traditional publishers who I would like to work with. And then I'm just going to move on, and just like, because it would be fun to do, and then move on. And I heard back from some, and they're like, you know, great book, but you know, you don't have the social media following. So, and it's what I thought, but that's fine.
Yeah, that's the world we're living in. When I first started my publishing journey, it was like you had to have 20,000 followers, which is, then it was 100,000 before, you know, 2 years later. And then it's like, yeah, well, I get it. That's how they make their money. That's how they have to make their money. But if our goal is to present a body of work to the world and get it to the right people, it doesn't require a million sales. It requires getting it to the people who need it. So it's a different kind of metric. And traditional publishing is not set up for that.
Right. And I've been rereading Mae Sarton's Journal of a Solitude, which is a fantastic book. And it was really wonderful. She was talking about one of her poetry books and how it wasn't really reviewed or picked up by the traditional press. And she says, well, I guess it's just going to have to go heart to heart and find its way into the world that way. And that moved me. And I thought, yes, that is how I want my book to go out into the world, from people who love it and pass it along from heart to heart. I thought that was fantastic.
That is great. Well, so how, I want to make sure that people know how to find your book, because I assume you're going to be at the bookshop.
Yep. It's at the Vashon Bookstore. Currently, you can also get it on Amazon.
Well, let's also tell people that I like to do this, to go to bookshop.org, because if they want to buy it online, they can buy it online through bookshop.org, and they will share profits with the Vashon Bookstore. So the owners at the bookstore love bookshop.org, and I feel so good that I can recommend a place if you're not on Vashon or near, you know, the wonderful Vashon bookshop, you can still buy it and support your local bookstore.
That is awesome. And yeah, that's really great. Thank you for, I didn't know about that.
Yeah, well, for some of us, I mean, you get beholden to Amazon as a writer. You just do. But you also grit your teeth and want to offer people alternatives.
And
bookshop.org is one of those. Do you think you'll be offering any workshops that people can go to? And tell me about that.
Well, currently I have a Substack. It's called Wild Authentic X for Explore, wildauthenticx.substack.com. And I'm newly really trying to get into a consistent schedule with writing there. And my goal with that Substack is to really dig in and get my new in the weeds with how to work some of these skills so that people have a real resource, and it's totally free. And also I'm doing various workshops in the community. I have one coming up. It's an online one for a group of psychiatric nurse practitioners, for example. But I am going to be offering one, and it's a donation-only one I'm doing over at OSpace.
And sweet.
It's March 30th.
Yeah.
It will be a day long. It's still coming together. It's going to be awesome, and it is going to be focused on boundaries. So if anyone's interested, because O Space is going to be promoting it and putting it out there, and you'll see it, but keep a mind on it. But there's only going to be 18 spots because it's a workshop, so it might go quickly. So just if you're interested, just pay attention.
And I'll leave a link in the episode notes on Voice of Vashon so that if people want to follow that up a little bit or go to O Space directly, either way, you know, that's great.
Yeah,
that's
great. Really exciting.
It sounds like we'll be hearing more from you. And
absolutely.
I'm left wanting more, which is always a great place to end an interview, because you've produced such a rich book and body of work that now will be applied and taken out in the world in different ways. So I want you back to find out what you discover and how it's getting applied.
Yeah.
So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm telling you, it's just wonderful to talk about this material and to hold each other up during these times. So thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon 101.9 FM for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.